From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The point of being in the streets is not to feel good or to express yourself. The point is to create an impression that George Bush deserves to be and can be defeated.
The point of being in the streets is to express our unequivocal opposition to the occupation and ongoing war in Iraq. And anyone handing out excuses for protesters to stay home may as well be working for Karl Rove.
To protest or not to protest? Today on Democracy Now!, a debate between Columbia University professor Todd Gitlin and independent journalist Naomi Klein. Then, as thousands begin to pour into New York for the Republican National Convention, we'll take a look at how unembedded independent journalists cover the protests.
Thousands of journalists will be covering the protests inside and out through web, radio, audio, and video, providing live, continuous coverage.
And the Fourth World War, a new film documenting global resistance.
People have been patient for 400 years. They expected 1994 to be the end of that 400 years of patience. They thought that Freedom Charter would exist in South Africa. But it does not exist. People in South Africa are still waiting for a revolution that didn't happen. And these people are angry.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In New York, a state Supreme Court judge has ruled the city of New York can ban the anti-war group United for Peace and Justice from holding a massive protest in Central Park on the eve of the Republican National Convention. United for Peace and Justice first applied for a permit for a rally over 14 months ago. The groups announced it will still hold a march on Sunday past Madison Square Garden, expected to draw hundreds of thousands of protesters. Last night, the group met with police and finalized the march route. Today, United for Peace and Justice will officially announce the march will end in Union Square. There's no organized post-march rally. In Iraq, the Shiite Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani has reportedly arrived in the holy city of Najaf after traveling with over 10,000 supporters from Basra. Upon Sistani's arrival, Najaf's governor announced a 24-hour ceasefire. In Najaf, Sistani is expected to call for all sides to put down their arms. A close associate for the Ayatollah said he plans to go to the Holy Imam Ali Shrine, pray, and receive the keys to the shrine from backers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Meanwhile, in Kufa, at least 27 people have died in an attack on a mosque. The Iraqis killed were gathering at the mosque for a peaceful protest to end the violence in Najaf. Another 20 people were shot dead in Kufa. It's not clear who's responsible for the attacks. In other news from Najaf, CNN reports Iraqi police rounded up 50 journalists at gunpoint last night from their hotel. The Washington Post reports police beat some of the reporters and fired assault rifles in the lobby. The journalists were taken to the local police station and berated for their coverage of Najaf. Police accused them of paying too much attention to Muqtada al-Sadr and not enough to the Iraqi police. When the journalists returned to their rooms, CNN reports they found many of their rooms had been ransacked and money had been stolen. For the first time, a U.S. Army general has admitted U.S. forces tortured Iraqis at the Abu Ghraib prison. Army Major General George Fay told a Pentagon briefing on Wednesday, quote, "It's a harsh word, and in some instances, unfortunately, I think it was appropriate here. There were a few instances where torture was being used." Yesterday, Fay and Lieutenant General Anthony Jones released a 143-page report that found military intelligence soldiers played a major role in directing and carrying out abuse on Iraqis. The report recommended that the Pentagon punish five military intelligence officers and 29 29 military intelligence soldiers at Abu Ghraib. Six employees from CACI International and Titan were also referred for prosecution. The report criticized the CIA for holding at least eight prisoners from the Red Cross. According to the report, one detainee was kept for 4 months in a 3-by-6-foot cell that didn't have a window, latrine, water tap, or bedding. On the campaign front, a chief attorney for the Bush-Cheney campaign resigned yesterday, less than 24 hours after it was revealed he was providing legal advice to a team of Vietnam veterans who claim John Kerry has fabricated his war record. Benjamin Ginsburg's resignation came as the Bush administration continued to charge it had no ties to the group known as the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. Meanwhile, Democrats called on Attorney General John Ashcroft to open a criminal investigation into illegal coordination between the Bush campaign and the veterans group. A manager of the Kerry Edwards campaign responded by saying, quote, "Now we know why George Bush refuses to specifically condemn these false ads. People deeply involved in his own campaign and behind them, from paying for them to appearing in them to providing legal advice to coordinating a negative strategy to divert the public away from issues like jobs, health care, and the mess in Iraq, the real concerns of the American people," Kerry said. And former Senator Max Cleland, a triple amputee from wounds received in the Vietnam War, traveled to Crawford, Texas yesterday and attempted to give President Bush a letter from nine senators calling on him to condemn the TV ads. He spoke to reporters in Crawford.
"This president has gone after three Vietnam veterans in 4 years. That's got to stop. This country is better than that. He went after John McCain when he got behind, when McCain won the New Hampshire primary and came south to South Carolina. The slime machine got cranked up. The smear campaign started. And McCain actually went on television and asked the president to stop it. He did not. And then when the president came after me in Georgia in 2002, Chuck Hagel asked them to stop putting me up there on the television with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, and they did not. And now nine members of the Senate and millions of Americans around the country are asking George Bush to make one phone call to his friends here in Texas and say, stop this insanity."
Former Senator Max Cleland, triple amputee from his wounds in Vietnam. Russian investigators said yesterday there's still no evidence that terrorists brought down two passenger jets that crashed almost simultaneously on Tuesday night, killing all 89 people aboard. Authorities did not rule out terrorism, but announced they're opening a criminal investigation into possible intelligence. The father of U.S. Marines set fire to the government van that three Marines drove to his house in Hollywood, Florida, to inform him that his 20-year-old son had died in Iraq. The man, Carlos Arredondo, suffered second-degree burns over half his body and is now in the hospital. No one else was injured. Alexander's stepmother, Melita, said, quote, "My husband knew his firstborn son had been killed, and my husband did not take the news well." His son, Alexander Arredondo, was killed in combat in Najaf. Nearly 1,000 U.S. soldiers have now died in Iraq.
This is what democracy sounds like. This is what democracy sounds like. This is what
La Tigra, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers and those listening in on www.democracynow.org. Well, thousands of activists have begun pouring into New York ahead of next week's Republican National Convention, yet the battle over permits for marches and rallies continues. Earlier this week, the Answer Coalition was denied a permit to hold a rally in Central Park on Saturday. Meanwhile, a state Supreme Court judge ruled yesterday that the city was justified in its refusal to grant United for Peace and Justice a permit to end its planned march on Sunday with a major rally in Central Park. Outside the courthouse, UFPJ's national coordinator, Leslie Kagan, gave her reaction to the judge's ruling.
August 29th, we are marching to say no to the Bush agenda. We are not happy, as you might imagine. We are quite upset by the court's ruling today. We believe the court is wrong. We believe this is actually a slap in the face of our constitutional rights, and that the struggle for the use of Central Park will continue long after the Republican convention is over. We are not giving up on this.
Leslie Kagan, coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, speaking yesterday outside New York State Supreme Court. Despite the legal setbacks, plans for scores of rallies, direct actions, and civil disobedience continue to move forward. Later in the program, we'll have a roundup of some of the events that are coming up over the next 10 days here in New York. But first, we turn to an issue being hotly debated right now. That's whether protest in New York will help or hurt George W. Bush and the Republicans. A few weeks back, we interviewed famed American writer, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Norman Mailer. Among his many books, he wrote one of the definitive accounts of the historic 1968 conventions. The book was called Miami and the Siege of Chicago. Here's what Norman Mailer had to say about the protest plan for the Republican National Convention in New York.
The immediate need is to defeat Bush. But to do that, we have to reach the middle. And the only way we can reach the middle at this late date is that if we're extraordinarily peaceful in our demonstrations before the election, because the media are just waiting there like coiled springs, hoping that there'll be a few maniacs who'll cut loose. Maybe there'll be a few people who'll know what to do with the American flag as far as the Republicans are concerned. And that is, the Republicans are hoping that we'll make assholes of ourselves. They're counting on that. And I would like to see the word go out to all the activists that we are walking into a tremendous trap. Why ever did the Republicans choose New York? Keep asking yourself that question. Leon Trotsky once said, there are certain questions that answer themselves by being asked. And that one, you ask yourself, you'll have the answer. Why did the Republicans choose New York? Let's not walk into their trap.
Norman Mailer speaking just a few days before the Democratic National Convention in Boston last month. The New York Times on Sunday reported that Republicans are seeking to turn any disruptions at the convention to their advantage by, quote, portraying protests by even independent activists as Democratic-sanctioned displays of disrespect for a sitting president. On Monday, Democratic National Committee Chair Terry McAuliffe held a conference call with reporters in which he distanced John Kerry and the Democrats from next week's demonstrations. Here is some of what DNC Chair Terry McAuliffe had to say.
Let me be crystal clear. I'd like to draw a line in the sand. We have nothing to do with the demonstrators. Republicans know that. Absolutely nothing. I want to be crystal clear. We want no disruptions at the Republican convention. We want the Republicans to have their convention in peace. We want them to have the same kind of peaceful convention that the Democrats held up in Boston. And there's a reason. We want to make sure that people hear what their message is. You know why? Because when they hear what they say, they'll see what the Republicans truly are, and they'll know what the Republicans don't know and what they're not going to do for America.
Terry McAuliffe, chair of the Democratic National Committee, speaking on a conference call with reporters on Monday. Well, to discuss the issue of to protest or not to protest, we're joined by two veterans of protest. Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology, Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist and author of Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate, as well as No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Todd Gitlin, let's begin with you. Your thoughts about this next week?
There is an urgent need, given the fact that we're in a national and as well global emergency, to defeat George Bush in the practical way that presidents can be defeated in the United States. And that is by doing everything possible to see that he's defeated on November 2nd. People who feel called upon to protest or to remember that their protest is taking place not on the streets of Manhattan, but it's taking place everywhere television and the internet reach. Nobody's running for president of Manhattan. To be contemptuous about the people's reactions elsewhere is to live in a cocoon of self-congratulation and not to be doing politics, but to be doing performance pieces. If people protest, they should do so exactly as Mailer said, in a dignified way, in a way that does not recruit voters for George W. Bush.
Naomi Klein, your response and your perspective?
Well, I certainly agree with Todd that this is an emergency, and the headlines that Amy just read from Iraq make that very, very clear. And personally, I don't think we have the luxury of waiting until November to oppose the war. We also heard that the protests have nothing to do with the Democrats. I would also disagree with that. I think they have a lot to do with the Democrats, precisely because the Democrats have really sealed off the possibility of just expressing your opposition to the war by voting. This isn't Spain. They are running on a hugely militaristic campaign. They are promising to continue the occupation, even expand the occupation of Iraq. So we need to be in the streets. The other thing I really want to take issue with Todd, I actually think he's making an unstrategic, unpolitical argument, and that's because there is going to be some disorder in the streets. If it isn't going to be protesters, it's going to be police posing as protesters. We've seen this. We've talked about it on this show. It happened in Miami. It'll happen again. The only way that we can protect ourselves from that is numbers. It's masses of people in the street. I don't believe, with all respect to Professor Gitlin, that the Black Bloc is his natural constituency. I don't think that they're listening to his advice. I think that the people are listening, that are listening, are actually the liberals who were planning to go out and oppose the use of their city as the backdrop. And I'd also like to disagree with Mr. Mailer that the Republicans chose New York as a trap. I think they chose New York because they thought they were going to be on a roll. I think they thought they chose New York because they thought they were going to be able to use the city's grief as a backdrop for their triumph in the war on terror. There's no moment for triumph. The problem is that Kerry is not willing to point that out because his advisors are telling him that he has to look equally tough, which means we are the only people who can oppose this war on the streets, and that's why we're going to be there. These warnings actually aren't working. There's going to be massive numbers of people on the streets.
We're talking to Naomi Klein and Todd Gitlin. We're going to break and then come back.
Anyway you make it, baby, won't you keep on moving it on? Now if you can't fly, run. You can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. Anyway, make it, baby, keep on moving it on. the rocks. Ain't much that can be changed. I'm sitting down singing my song. I sing to find the spirit and keep him up bright and strong. Anyway you pick it, baby, you keep on moving on. Any old way you can pick it, baby, you keep on moving on. Now if you can't fly, run to the folks, tell them this.
Odetta, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Naomi Klein, author of Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate. Her forthcoming article in The Nation magazine is called Bring Najaf to New York. We're also joined by Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, author of several books, including Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives, and the 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. Juan?
Todd, you have an article in the newest issue of The Nation, No Bush, No Chicago 68, where you attempt to draw parallels between what happened in Chicago in 1968 and what could possibly happen next week here in New York. Now, I was a member of SDS in 1968, as you were a member of SDS, and I was in Chicago that year, and know precisely what happened in terms of how the media turned that against the demonstrators and mobilized the public sentiment for the Republicans. But how do you answer these young people who are fed up and furious with what's going on in Iraq when they see that a John Kerry doesn't have a much more different position on the situation in Iraq than President Bush, where they see that both political parties are arguing more about a war that ended 30 years ago than they are talking about the current war that is eating away at the social fabric of our country?
Well, first of all, Juan, let's clarify. The article in The Nation, I'm the co-author of it. The other co-author is John Passacantando, who's the executive director of Greenpeace USA. And I think I say that not only to be accurate, but also to underscore that the position that we're taking is not that protest is a bad idea. It is that there is an overwhelming imperative, and that imperative is to defeat the administration that stands in the way of any progress. Now, I don't, whether it's on Iraq or on the environment or on any other issue, my position is not that John Kerry is either Jesus Christ or the Prophet Muhammad. My position is that John Kerry is the possibility of restarting politics. Right now, we have no possibility of politics because we have a one-party state. That state can be defeated, and to say that we don't have the luxury of waiting to November 2nd is to say we don't have the luxury of the U.S. Constitution. I beg to differ. We have the luxury of the U.S. Constitution. We have the possibility of defeating this reactionary cabal that I think it is not difficult to see is an absolute refutation of the possibility of any constructive change for the foreseeable future. And that is an absolute imperative. This is, when I say this is an emergency, is not to say that we must, and now I'm going to your direct question, to say this is an emergency is not to say that all we have are our passionate rages. I, believe me, understand the passionate rage to defeat George Bush. But we're living in a world of grown-ups here. There is a way to defeat George Bush. Standing on a street corner and either inaugurating or conspiring with the police to do some mayhem, to put on a performance piece that dramatizes the theatrics of rage, is the most self-indulgent thing I can imagine. And I think we ought to be very, very careful before we listen to the advice of those who 4 years ago assured us that we didn't have the luxury of waiting to defeat American corporations. We had to do it right now by voting for Ralph Nader.
Naomi Klein.
Well, when I say we don't have the luxury, I mean there is a war going on right now. And if we are an anti-war movement, we don't get to choose our strategic moments to oppose a war and ask ourselves how it's going to play in swing states. We oppose wars when they are being waged. And there is an emergency in Najaf right now. And people in Iraq are flocking to Najaf, acting as human shields. Sistani just yesterday called for massive peaceful demonstrations. I think the least we can do is not... You know, I actually really quite resent this idea that protest is infantile. I think it is a very politically mature and I think responsible. I think the onus is on Americans because it is their bombs dropping on Najaf. To be in the streets making concrete demands to end the occupation, to end the siege on Najaf, for massive reparations for Iraq. And I really believe that the arguments that Todd Gitlin is making is really part of a three-pronged strategy to scare people out of the streets of New York. I think part of it, people are afraid of terrorism. They're now afraid of anarchists because it's being whipped up by the tabloids. And I think into this debate is being inserted this false analogy with Chicago Stick 68 that says to liberals in New York who were really feeling defiant and were planning to show some real courage on the streets, that actually you can do more by staying home than being in the streets. I don't think that what we're going to see on the streets is, you know, is a temper tantrum. I think that there is serious, mature opposition to this war, and that the onus, all of us who marched against the war before it started, is to bring those voices from Najaf. You know, I was there. I wasn't in Chicago in 68. I hadn't been born yet. But I really feel a tremendous responsibility to the people I met in Iraq to bring those voices here, because they're being crushed there, and we owe it to them.
Juan, I'm looking at your newspaper, the Daily News. You have a piece inside about the decision by the judge not to allow the protesters in Central Park, a traditional place of protest. But the front page screaming headline is Police Intelligence Warning, Anarchy, Inc. Hardcore Troublemakers, a Threat to Republican Convention.
Yes, and actually my column, which is, I always tell people, the further back it's buried in the paper, the more important it is, was buried far away from those stories. But I think that the reality is that the police department and law enforcement have been regularly leaking information on supposed anarchist groups that are coming, or violent anarchist groups. And those of us who have covered these protests and over the years, from Seattle to Philadelphia and Los Angeles, the last conventions, and also in Miami, know that the number of people engaged in these kinds of vandalism, which is more what it would be called in violence, is minuscule. But the attention always focuses not on the hundreds of thousands that come to protest in a specific way. But on the few who might be bent, as I call them, knuckleheads, who might be bent on some trouble.
Todd Gitlin, your response to the issue that the opposition party, the Democratic Party, is not offering an alternative, what we're seeing in Iraq right now?
What the Democratic Party has had to say about Iraq has been disappointing. The absolute condition of their doing something which isn't disappointing is putting them in power. The absolute impossibility of doing anything decent, whatever the symbolic display of protest, is in the hands of the George Bush administration. This seems to me a matter of absolute logic. And to slander my arguments by saying that I'm part of a strategy to stop the protest is just sounds like the Swift Vote Veterans for so-called truth. This is just slander. It's a refusal of the argument. Again, we are not voting on November 2nd to usher in the millennium. There are many things in the world that will continue to be awful. We are ushering in the possibility of politics. Strikes me as very peculiar that somebody who understands or purports to understand the force and wickedness of the Bush administration thinks that symbolic protests will stop them. Symbolic protests stopped nothing in February of 2003, because that's not the way the world works. Symbolic protests next week, however good it makes anybody feel, however righteous, will not stop George Bush. There's only one thing that will stop George Bush, and it's what takes place on November 2nd.
as I said before, I'm really much less interested in stopping George Bush than in stopping a war. And I don't think that these have to be symbolic protests. I wish that we were in a situation where people could vote against the war in massive numbers for John Kerry, for the Democrats, who are, in fact, the only people who have a chance of defeating Bush. They closed off that door. This isn't Spain. So this means that the only...
And explain what you mean when you keep saying this isn't Spain.
In Spain, they had the possibility of voting for a politician who promised to pull his troops out, and in fact did. That renewed a real faith in democracy in that country and around the world. And, you know, when I was in Iraq when that happened, and there was a real hope that maybe that could happen in the United States. And the Democrats have systematically sealed off that possibility, and I believe pushed people into the streets. And to dismiss that as a symbolic temper tantrum, I think is quite absurd. I also want to be very clear, Todd, I am not saying that you are deliberately playing into Karl Rove's hands, but practically, I believe that you are. Because what the Republicans want is to dismiss our protests as marginal, to make us look crazy,
wrong.
To make us look
exactly
extreme.
Wrong.
That's what they want.
No,
and what they want
are,
no, Todd, let me speak. What they want is they want to reduce the numbers. And what you are doing, who's actually listening to you, and I've talked to many New Yorkers, they're not the people that you're afraid of making trouble. They're the people who are liberals in this city, who were planning to be part of the United for Peace and Justice March on Sunday, who are getting frightened because there isn't a permit. All the other fear strategies are working. And now they actually have a nice, progressive-sounding get-out-of-protest-free card that says, you know what, go out of town, go on holiday. You're actually helping because you're not playing into the Republicans' hands.
Just to be clear, there is a permit, though. There's a permit to march
right.
past Madison Square Garden,
there
and
is.
They're going to go back to Union Square, but not to march in Central Park, though many are saying that they will go there afterwards. Todd Gitlin, final response.
Final? Look, my position is not that people should not protest. It is that people should take steps that ensure that the disruptors, the Rove fans, are marginalized. United for Peace and Justice could have done us all a big favor by training monitors that would contain those people who seek only mayhem in order to further their performance piece. Since the UPJ decided not to do that, I think those who march peacefully ought to feel that they have a responsibility to contain and limit the damage that's being done by the wackos. And recognizing that the media will lead with the most raucous, most destructive people they can find, and that Rove's people will also be fanning the flames of the raucousness. That's also a responsibility of people who demonstrate, and I think it's one to be taken quite seriously.
Isn't it also, Todd, a responsibility of the media, and as you would want to have the protesters be responsible, the issue of journalists also being responsible about the way they cover these
absolutely.
Events?
Absolutely.
Critically?
I mean, we wrote that in our piece in The Nation. Unfortunately, I have low expectations for journalists. I mean, at the first sound of breaking glass, they drop what they were doing and they'll rush there. And unfortunately, that's a given. But journalism is in this way an implement of the forces of repression.
Todd Gitlin, we gave you the first word. Naomi, we give you the last.
You know, I absolutely agree. We know what we're up against in terms of media coverage. We know they're going to play up whatever violence there is. We know what we're up against in terms of police violence, in terms of provocation, in terms of Republican spin. Our only weapon is numbers, is being in the streets. This is a moment for massive courage to stand up against all this fear-mongering, just say we're going anyway, because we know that there are a lot of problems with this country, Amy, but too much dissent is not one of them, okay? And anyone telling people to stay out of the streets, frankly, Todd has a lot to answer for.
Naomi Klein, Todd Gitlin, we want to thank you very much for being with us. We're going to go to an early break, and then we're going to talk about what are the plans for next week. And then we're going to put these protests in context of a global resistance movement. Then, finally, the good news. Community radio station KGNU in Boulder has just bought a Denver radio station, one of the rare times in this country when a community radio station actually expands in this age of the clear channeling of America. Stay with us.
Turn me around, well, keep on a-walking, keep on a-talking, marching up to freedom land. Well, ain't gonna let segregation, Lordy. Turn me around, well, turn me around, well, turn me around, ain't gonna let segregation, Lordy. Turn me around, well, keep on a-walking, keep on a-talking, marching up to freedom land. Well, ain't gonna let no police dogs turn me around, well, turn me around, well, turn me around, ain't gonna let no police dogs turn me around, well, keep on a-walking, keep on a-talking, marching up to freedom land. Well, ain't gonna let no sheriff, Lordy, turn me around, well, turn me around, well, turn me around, ain't gonna let no sheriff, Lordy, turn me around, said, keep on a-walking, keep on a-talking, marching up to freedom land.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, Julius Lester. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on over 240 community radio stations, Pacifica stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS, and both satellite networks, on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, Link TV. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, much of the corporate media's coverage of the protests in the run-up to the convention has focused on whether or not organizers will have a city permit for their planned demonstrations against the Republican Party.
What's not being talked about is in the mainstream media is who the tens of thousands of protesters are and why they're taking to the streets during the convention. Some 200 marches, rallies, direct actions are planned for the week and organized by groups from across the spectrum representing peace and environmental, religious, immigrant, youth, and community organizations. In an open letter to journalists released yesterday, protest organizers urged the corporate media to ensure fair, balanced, and accurate coverage of the demonstrations at the Republican convention. The letter reads, quote, "We are concerned by the slant of some of the media coverage that's focused on potential violence or made unsubstantiated and sensationalist claims about the activists who will be demonstrating."
Along with the hundreds of thousands of protesters expected in New York, well over 1,000 unembedded journalists will be working out of the New York Independent Media Center. The IMC last week published 200,000 copies of a special edition of its newspaper, The Independent. It features guides on everything from the schedule of protests to where people can stay, as well as news and analysis of the election and presidency.
We're joined right now by two guests. Arun Gupta is former editor of The Guardian, one of the most respected independent newspapers in recent U.S. history. He's currently editor of with the New York City Independent Media Center's newspaper, The Independent. Also, Rick Rowley is with us. He is an independent filmmaker, journalist who's traveled the world telling the stories of resistance movements. Most recently, he has just come back from several months in Iraq, one of the founders of Big Noise Tactical Media. His new film, produced with his partner Jackie Suen, premieres tonight in New York. It's called The Fourth World War, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Arun. Can you talk about what is happening in this next week? Your newspaper, The Independent, I think it's the largest circulation, what, of an independent newspaper in a long time here in this country.
That's right, or at least that's what we've been able to determine so far. We've had some research librarians look into it, and from what they've been able to dig up, no other paper, alternative, grassroots paper, has done a print run of more than 100,000 in over 30 years. The records are incomplete from the 60s, but is at least as far back as the early 70s.
So this print run is 200,000?
200,000, and we'll be coming out tomorrow with another issue of over 100,000. We're just trying to basically fit into the moment and generate a lot of information and also publicity about what's happening, and basically to provide a counter to a lot of the fear-mongering that's going out there.
And how are you distributing the newspaper?
It's a real grassroots effort. It's pretty amazing. We've mobilized scores, maybe over 100 people, to do it in all sorts of ways. We have people driving around, dropping it off at hundreds of spots, people rolling laundry carts and grocery carts down the street with like 500 papers in them, stopping in every store, teams going out into the subways. We're hitting all the hundreds of events that Amy mentioned. So we're really trying to blanket the city as much as possible.
Let's talk about some of those events. Give us a brief schedule of what we're going to see in these coming days, or at least what's planned right now.
Well, I think it's important to point out that there's an amazing almost like cultural and festival atmosphere. That's not what's going to get the press. There's all sorts of concerts, Poets Against the War, film festivals, there's a Green Festival, all sorts of outdoor public space festivals. What's going to get the press are the protests, the marches. And those divide up into two basic areas. There's the non-permitted versus the permitted. As you mentioned, UFPJ has the permitted march on Sunday. They've been trying for more than a year to get Central Park, and of course it was turned down repeatedly. So they'll be having a march, which estimates are it'll probably draw well in excess of 100,000 people, which I think is pretty amazing given all the fear-mongering and terror scares. And this city is really clearing out. Also, a lot of people are clearing out, but many people are also coming in. We've seen a very large infusion, and there'll be many New Yorkers out there. There are two other events the same day that fall into the non-permitted category. Because of the police denial of Central Park, there's been 6 or 7 calls that we can count for people to gather in Central Park. Everything, like Reverend Billy at one point called for a mass wedding on the Great Lawn, though I think now he's just calling for some sort of powwow. There's the Libertarians are calling for Reclaim Central Park, not in our name. A militant group is also calling for people to gather in the park. And there may be chaos that results, but if it does, it'll be from the police because people want to be able to peacefully express themselves and enjoy the city. And I think it's very important to point out, especially in relation to the last conversation, that every single group has committed itself to peaceful action. Indie Media actually talks to all the organizers. We've talked to every single organizing group. Everybody is going to be doing nonviolent protests. They are very clear we want peaceful action. So if any chaos does occur, I think it'll become from policing policies, and not even from the beat cops, because they're really pissed off, frankly, because of contract negotiations. And so the rumor is they don't really want to be dealing with all this overtime, all this chaos, but it's the higher up, the brass, and frankly, I think the Republicans who are putting pressure on them and instituting this campaign to deny the use of any sort of public space. And so the Reclaim the Park is an effort to say this is our city. It's the Republicans who are invading it. And then later that evening, you're going to have what's called the Mouse Block. People are calling for folks to come to Broadway, where the Republicans, the Elephants, will be going to Disney-sanctioned theater. That's a funny little anecdote about how the city or how the Republican Party didn't want the Republican delegates to see such stuff as Assassins, which is a Stephen Sondheim musical, I believe, about people who tried to assassinate the president, or Rent, which is a gritty musical about the Lower East Side. And
well, they're actually going, as I understand it, to about 7 or 8 different Broadway shows, all sponsored by the New York Times.
Right.
Special performances for the Republican delegates. So what the liberal New York Times is doing, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars bankrolling entertainment for a partisan political organization, I'm not quite sure about, but it hasn't gotten much attention in most of the press.
Yeah, and there were some people who were joking about how protesters should sponsor people to go see Assassins, and as a counter to that. But it really is amazing. It shows you where the corporate press comes down, even the liberal establishment.
But instead, they're offering discounts to, is it Naked Boys Singing?
So, yeah, something like that.
Tuesday a day of direct action. Can you talk about
Tuesday's
that?
Tuesday's a day of direct action, but I'd actually also like to mention Monday, because this actually may be the most incredible thing that goes on. The Kensington Welfare Rights Union, which organized a nonviolent protest in Philadelphia at the Republican National Convention there in 2000, will be doing the same. In 2000, the Philly police refused to give them a permit. They marched anyway. Nobody was arrested. This time, what they're saying they're going to do, it's going to be, we talked to the organizers, they say that they are going to have over 10,000 people, and they're going to march from Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza across from the United Nations to Madison Square Garden. And they're asking the police for a permit, but not one is forthcoming. And it's not surprising, because from what I've talked to them and from what I saw in a press release, they're going to march up to the front doors of Madison Square Garden, or that's a plan, and they want to issue an arrest warrant for George Bush. And so it's great theater. But obviously the police aren't going to give them a permit for that. They say, we're going to march anyway. So they're calling for mass nonviolent civil disobedience. Now, they are very much in many ways a poor people's movement. And according to their organizers, they're going to have 1,000 poor families, hundreds of disabled people, a large contingent of blind people, clergy, international human rights observers from Latin America that they've invited. So you're going to get this spectacle of thousands and thousands of people, especially the most vulnerable of society. And this puts a city in a real dilemma, and the Republicans. Do you have the cops attack children, the disabled, the blind, or do you let them march to the front door? And that gives lie to all the fear-mongering and scares that, you know, we can't have people marching around the city. So the cops and the city are kind of damned if they do or damned if they don't. I can't see the cops letting them march, but that means they're going to have to try and arrest or bottle up 10,000 people, and it could be crazy. Now, what Tuesday is that represents kind of the traditional direct action movement that came out of Seattle, if something can be traditional after 5 years. And it's a lot of anti-globalization activists. Again, they've also committed themselves to mass nonviolent action. They want to do civil disobedience. There's talk about sit-downs in the streets, maybe some blockades of intersections. It's all still being figured out. Various estimates have been put how many people are being talked about, and it is probably going to be thousands of people. And one of the things that needs to be emphasized, again, why they're organizing it is because they want to say, we have a right to be in the streets. We have a right for peaceful redress of grievances, and we don't have to go through these permitting games. And basically, the First Amendment is the only permit we need. And so this has become, in many ways, just a battle over the to exercise constitutional rights, and that's very important to understand.
Rick Rowley, you're an independent filmmaker. You'll be covering the protests in the streets around the convention. But you've been doing this all over the world for years. Because of the whole debate over the permit, it's become a discussion of logistics as opposed to content. Your film, The Fourth World War, which is opening tonight at the Anthology Theater in New York, is all about why people protest from Argentina to Mexico, South Africa, Palestine, Korea. Can you talk about why?
Yeah. I think the use of fear here in New York and in the States. It's amazing to see the way that movements respond in other parts of the world. I mean, like the movements in Argentina, their analysis is that that fear is the tool that corporate globalization, that neoliberalism, that this empire, it is the tool it uses to achieve political consensus, that it's the way that it enters in. And whether it's fear of violence in the street, or whether it's economic fear of losing your job, fear that your family won't have a future, fear of losing your house, and that moments of uprising, the moments of uprising that we've documented in the Fourth World War and that we try to film everywhere are moments when that fear breaks, when collective networks of solidarity are capable of breaking that fear and of creating a space where it's safe for people to go out and put their voice and their bodies in the street against these machines.
I want to go to a clip of Fourth World War, this from Argentina.
Se rompió algo, se rompió. Something broke. The illusion that corporate globalization was going to bring us happiness. The illusion that this was democracy. But fundamentally, what broke on the 19th was the last element of state terror.
Those in power attempt to spread the idea in the entire population that their way of life is the only way. There's only one homogenous linear moment in which everything in the future is the same as the present and the past. You cannot hope for any kind of change. There are no ruptures in history.
Sin embargo, a veces hay rupturas.
But there are ruptures.
Hay rupturas tremendas,
tremendous ruptures that shatter this dominant history.
No rutinas,
and there are no routines.
No
there can be no predictions. And things happen that no one understands.
Previsibilidad y pasan cosas que nadie entiende.
A clip from Fourth World War in Argentina. And then, Rick, you go to Palestine.
Occupation. Curfew. Settlement. Administrative detention, preemptive strike, terrorist infrastructure, attrition, transfer. Their war destroys language, speaks genocide with the words of a quiet technician. Occupation means that you cannot trust the open sky or any open street beneath the gaze of their sniper towers. It means that you cannot trust the future or have faith that the past will always be there. Occupation means you live out your life under military rule and the constant threat of death. A quick death from a sniper's bullet or a rocket attack from an F-16. A crushing, suffocating death beneath the rubble of a bulldozed building. A slow, bleeding death in an ambulance held for hours at a checkpoint. A dark death on the torture tables of an Israeli prison. A random, arbitrary death. As their tanks spray a crowd with machine gun fire, a cold, calculated death from malnutrition and curable diseases, 1,000 small deaths as you watch your family die around you. Occupation means that every day you die and the world watches in silence, as if your death were nothing, as if it were a stone falling to the earth or water falling over water. And if you face all of this death and indifference and keep your humanity and your love and your dignity and refuse to surrender to their terror and despair, then you know something of the courage that is Palestine.
And that the Palestinian poet Suher Hamad, together with Michael Franti, they narrate this film, Fourth World War. Rick Rowley, how you cover these resistance movements around the world, from South Korea to Palestine to South Africa?
Well, there's two things to say. The first is that media is a weapon of war, and that everything about the way that the corporate media covers these places, conflicts at home and abroad, participates in a military logic of terror, isolation, and fragmentation. I mean, we see the war abroad shot from the noses of bombs in Iraq. We hear it narrated by generals. So as an intervention against this politics of fear and isolation, we wanted to create the possibility for an identification with people on the other side of that massive military and media machine. So we put the cameras in the streets with people who are putting their bodies on the line, every day. I mean, when you go and cover a war zone or a protest, you decide before you go about whose side you're on, whether you're with the people or the military, the people or the protesters, and then you assume the risks, or it is your responsibility in as much as it's possible to assume the risks of the people who you're filming with. So the corporate media films with the police, and all they risk are their souls. We film with people in the streets. And, you know, I mean, I go to Palestine and I go armed to the teeth with the weapons of privilege. I come with my skin and my passport, which makes me, you know, not impossible to kill, but a lot more difficult to kill. But it's our responsibility there to at least put our bodies and our cameras, on the front lines with people. That is the least that we owe to these people who are part of our movement around the world.
And how do you deal with the limitations inherent in film itself? That you are obviously holding a camera, that whether it's the repressive forces or those who are fighting against oppression, they see you pointing that camera at them, how do you reach a certain degree of invisibility so that what you're chronicling is not, in essence, to some degree, whether people realize it or not, staged?
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't think of ourselves as journalists in the same kind of way. I mean, we are making collaborative media in conjunction with movements. We're media produced in through movements. This is a film that would have been impossible to make even 5 years ago. It was made possible through a global network of activists and movements and independent media people around the world that really hasn't existed before. So when we arrive in a place like South Africa, the day we arrive, we're traveling around and filming with South African Indie Media, which is basically a wing of the anti-eviction campaign, the anti-privatization movement, is connected with grassroots movements on the ground. So we go, I mean, there's a long and really exploitative history of ethnography and of a kind of film that goes down and tries to capture the indigenous heart of darkness in, you know, one place or another. We go down and we make these films as self-consciously as part of a global movement that's connected to people, not as observers on the outside, but as participants. So the message should be, the war isn't 3,000 miles away. The war isn't in some jungle or some mountain or some desert. The war is right here in the streets of New York City under our feet.
Rick Rowley and Arun Gupta, we are also joined by Chris Abrams, former senior producer of Democracy Now!, now spearheading the campaign for a community radio station, KGNU, in Boulder, Colorado, to expand into Denver. And this past week, they announced their success, which is highly unusual, a community radio station expanding in this age of the clear channeling of America. And Chris joins us on the line right now from Boulder. Welcome, Chris. It's great to have you with us. We only have a few minutes, but can you talk about this latest news announcing the buying of a radio station in Denver, which will now reach 5 times your audience in this absolutely critical year?
Media consolidation. And it's also a story about the war, because people in Denver for years have been approaching KGNU and asking KGNU to find a way to broadcast there. Denver does not have a grassroots volunteer-powered community radio station like Boulder does, and they realized that this would be important for their communities. But when the Bush administration rolled out its PR campaign in September of 2003 to try to drum up support for the war on Iraq, the corporate media failed to do its job. You know, we've seen the New York Times apologizing. We've seen now the Washington Post senior editors saying there that we are inevitably the mouthpiece for whatever administration is in power. And the people of Denver realized this, and the request to KGNU increased. And KGNU stepped up. I think it's incredible that the people of Boulder, we've raised over $1.2 million to make this happen. And most of that money is coming from the people of Boulder, because they realize that access to programs like Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News and the local independent reporting that community stations do all over the country isn't just about your own community, but it's about democracy in this country. And if people in cities all over the country don't have access to this, it affects you wherever you are. And so they put up $1.2 million. The down payment is $1 million for this station to make this happen. If you want more information, go to kgnu.org. We still need help. And you can contact me at chris@kgnu.org, K-R-I-S@kgnu.org.
And your first day of broadcast, Chris?
This Sunday, we'll be broadcasting, carrying the Pacifica coverage live from the streets of New York City, where hundreds of thousands are expected to protest against the Republican National Convention.
Thank you so much, Chris Abrams, broadcasting from KGNU in Boulder, now expanding to Denver. We'll put the websites for more information on our website. And the Fourth World War website tells you where Fourth World War will be around the country. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.